down.
Call the meeting to order. Good morning. This is State Government Finance Committee meeting for Wednesday, February 9th, 2011. And we're still waiting for a person or two for a quorum, so we'll do the minutes a little later as soon as we have a quorum. We have a number of presentations this morning, and first we'd like to call forward Sue Jens, the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board. Ms. Jens, would you please come forward and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sue Jens, and I think I'm going to move this chair. I can't see all of you.
Thank you so much.
It's early in the morning. We should be able to greet one another.
Cummins.
And thank you to the Historical Society for helping me with the technology today. I am Sue Jens. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Arts Board, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be with you to give you an overview of our agency and what we do and the services that we provide to the state of Minnesota. For some of you, as I look around the room, I will be reacquainting you with what we do. And for others, I think this may be the first chance that you'll hear about what we do. I'm going to go very quickly through some slides, and I believe you have a handout as well with all of the slides that I have. Go very quickly and then leave time at the end for your questions or anything else that you'd like to explore. Pardon me. Minnesota State Arts Board exists in state statute. We are a state agency. We are governed by the laws, and our roles, our responsibilities, our authority is outlined in Chapter 129D. Boiled down to its essence, our job is to stimulate and encourage the creation, performance, and appreciation of the arts in the state of Minnesota. Often when I give this presentation, I do this as trivia, but because some of you know the answers, I won't do that today. But Minnesota legislature created a state arts agency in 1903, 2 years before the state capitol was built, a year after automobiles came to Minnesota, 16 years before Minnesota ratified the 16th Amendment. So more than 100 years ago, elected officials and Minnesotans decided that the arts had a place in state government, and we have had that role ongoing since then. It's evolved. It's changed over time. Our current name and our current structure were adopted in 1977. So why? Why have the arts be part of state government? Well, it's because Minnesotans care about the arts. We know that's true. About two-thirds of Minnesotans report that they are involved in the arts in their daily lives on an ongoing basis. 82% of Minnesotans say that public funding is important for the arts, so that it's not just the wealthy of us who have the chance to be involved with the arts, but that all Minnesotans will have ways that are affordable and accessible to them. Minnesotans overwhelmingly understand the role that arts play in education, not just understanding and learning how to make an art form, but the way that the arts stimulate the mind and our cognitive abilities. And finally, Minnesotans care about the arts because they think it's one of the reasons that people want to live here and want to work here. It's one of the things that sets us apart, certainly in the Midwest, but across the country as well. We are routinely recognized as one of the arts communities across the country. A little bit of context. The nonprofit arts industry in Minnesota represents about $1 billion of economic activity a year. And I know that economic activity is one of the most important things that all of you will be talking about during this session. We believe that we're a piece of the solution. I know we're not the whole solution, but we play a role in that. There are jobs that are affected by the arts. There are about 1,400 nonprofit arts and cultural organizations in the state of Minnesota. You see the economic impact of that is about $840 million per year. 22,000 jobs are supported through the economic activities of arts and cultural organizations. We're home to about 30,000 artists. individuals who are sole proprietors, single owners of businesses, and they also have about a $200 million economic impact on the state of Minnesota. They purchase supplies, they purchase services, and they obviously pay state and local taxes. Beyond the economics, there are a variety of other ways that the arts contribute to the things that we believe make Minnesota a great place to live and to work. The arts help strengthen our communities. They help bridge different racial, ethnic, and cultural groups. They're part of our tourism industry in Minnesota, which is growing. I'm going to skip ahead. They help young people prepare for the future. They bring visibility to our state. And one of the things that we're hearing more and more is that businesses look to the arts, look to creativity as the number one skill that they need when they're recruiting new workers. Like leadership, creativity is a skill that can be taught, it can be learned, it can be practiced. And studying in the arts exercises the imagination in ways that will become more and more important to our future industries. So our bottom line is that we want all Minnesotans to be able to participate in the arts, whether it's as an actor or a singer or a performer, whether it's as an audience member, or whether it's a restaurant owner in Red Wing. I was there a week or so ago and was talking with an arts organization there that said they do a fall arts festival, and all of the restaurants have come to them now and said, could you do more of these? Because that one weekend that you do the festival is the one weekend that all of our restaurants are full in Red Wing. So they're seeing the connection between that activity and other kinds of businesses. I'll talk very quickly about the structure. Like the state legislature and then local and city governments, we have a two-tiered structure in Minnesota. There is the Minnesota State Arts Board. We have 11 members who are appointed by the governor, approved by the Senate. We rely very heavily on citizen involvement. Last year, we used more than 200 individuals to help us do our work, mostly in helping us decide how to invest the dollars that have been entrusted to us. We are very small. We have a staff of 11, and two of us are here right now. So you have a critical mass of our staff members with you today. We also are directed by state statute to be the fiscal agent for 11 regional arts councils. You have the boundaries drawn here. Nine of them are independent nonprofit organizations. Two of them are organizations that are based in their regional development commission, although they are about to transition and become independent nonprofits as well. The structure was set up intentionally so that there would be statewide decision making and statewide investment, but there would also be local decision making and local investment. And regional arts councils are directed to understand the needs of their regions and their communities and to provide services that are targeted to meet those needs. Collectively, as a system, we serve all 87 counties and communities throughout the state.
Ms. Jens, before you move on,
yes, sir.
Could you say more about the relationship of these regional art councils to the regional development commissions and what kind of working relationships there are, recognizing that not all of the regional development commissions are operating, but could you say more about the relationship and connection there?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. If you look at the map, Region 1 up in the left-hand corner and Region 7E are the two regional arts councils that are still affiliated with the Regional Development Commission. When the structure was created in 1976, 1977, all of them were programs of a Regional Development Commission, and over time, for various reasons, they have evolved out of those. They have moved out to become separate nonprofits. The last two that are still a part of their regional development commissions are right now working on a separation. In both cases, they will still do some joint services, some joint programs, but they will be separate. They will have their own authority and autonomy to make decisions. And so in the case of, I'll pick Region 1 as an example, the staff person who is managing the Arts Council in that region has also been involved with tourism and with aging programs. And so her responsibilities were split between a variety of different programs. Separating into a separate nonprofit with a relationship with the Regional Development Commission allows her to focus full-time on arts, but still take advantage, say, of financial services or some of the shared services that might be available. So in each region, it's been very different, and the timing for how those separations happened has been very different over the past, I would say, 15 or 20 years that evolution has taken place.
From the State Arts Board perspective, is it good that they're independent and separated, or is that potentially causing some difficulty in building local support from your local governments that participate in the regional development commissions?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, I think that there is value in them being standalones because they can focus specifically on the arts. Each of the regional arts councils works hard to maintain a relationship with the development commission if there is one, but also with their county governments and their local governments. One of the things that we as a system have said we'd like to do is to see more arts interwoven into community activities, community planning, other facets of community life. And so the regional arts councils spend a great deal of their time cultivating those relationships, understanding what the needs might be and what roles arts could play in those communities. So it is an extra relationship and an extra attending and collaboration that they need to do, but they can come from an independent, a very strong point of view and bring something to the table to help those development commissions, we believe, where there are those. The regional arts councils also have a relationship with the McKnight Foundation and with the community initiatives. And so they're building relationships both in the public sector but also in the private sector. They play an intersecting role.
Well, thank you. Thank you for that explanation. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a very quick summary of the kinds of things that the Arts Board and Regional Arts Councils do: grants, programs, services. The one slide that you have summarizes most of our key activities that we collectively as a system provide. First and foremost, we're interested in building the capacity of the nonprofit sector. We want that billion-dollar industry not only to continue to be a billion-dollar industry, but to be bigger and to play an even more important role in the success of the state. We want our artists and our arts organizations pardon me, to develop not only their artistic skills, but their professional capacities, their ability to run their businesses and be successful at marketing themselves. We play a role in tourism, as I mentioned before, in community and economic development. We all are very interested in arts in education, and we've taken on a broader concept of what that means, not just arts in schools, but lifelong learning in the arts. Whether you're 3 or 83, what role can the arts play in your creative abilities and development? The Arts Board is funded by the federal government, and so we have a role to play in helping organizations understand their ADA responsibilities. And beyond that, not just the responsibilities, but the real value of making the arts accessible to every person, no matter what his or her abilities might be. Bottom line, our job is to connect Minnesotans to the arts in whatever way they'd like to be connected. Grant making is a principal function. Very, very little of the money that comes to us from the state of Minnesota stays at the Arts Board or stays with the regional arts councils. We turn those dollars around into grants to artists, to arts organizations, to schools, to community groups, to other nonprofits as quickly as we can. We have a three-tiered structure here. Staff play a role in planning, technical assistance, making sure that anybody who might be able to take advantage of one of our programs or services knows about it, understands how to access it. Our staff don't decide who will be funded. We facilitate a decision-making process, and then we manage the grants once they're approved. We use advisors. I'll talk about them a little bit more in just a moment, but their job really is to review all of the grant proposals that come in and to make recommendations on which of them are the strongest proposals to be funded. Again, that's not a staff function. Our board and each of the regional arts council's board has final authority over which of the grants are funded to approve or deny those funds.
Question from Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Gems, since you were on the subject there of what your staff does, and you'd earlier testified that you had 11 employees, it came to my attention that you had a hiring request, or you posted on your website that you were hiring three new positions of January 1st. Have you filled those positions?
Ms. Jens?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, we have not yet filled those positions. We had three positions posted. They will be program staff positions. We received 800 applications, and we are now at the point of interviewing to fill those positions.
Okay.
Representative Benson.
So you're going to go from 11 to 14, and the reason for that is the additional workload related to the increased number of dollars you're getting from the legacy fund? Will their job be to, and this is multiple questions, will their job be to administer the grant money and look at all the applications for that grant money?
Ms. Jens?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, they are program staff. Two of them will be considered program officers in the state of Minnesota, so their job will be to facilitate the decision-making. They do review all the applications, but it's their job to help our volunteers make the best decisions that they can. And the third position will be somebody who will help with the technical assistance, answering questions. We get countless calls and emails every week saying, is there a way that I can benefit from programs at the Arts Board? Is there a grant program? Is there a service? This is my project. This is my program. And someone who will be more available to answer those questions so that anybody who would like to take advantage of these dollars has a better chance of doing so.
Okay, for this committee, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, thank you. For this committee, then, you've had such an increase in funds coming from the legacy fund that it was important that you hire enough staff that you could take care of the influx of both the money and the request for the grant funding.
Ms. Jones?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, that's true. We have some of you who may remember the process of how the legacy dollars started and when the funds were available to us. We took the first 6 months of fiscal 10 and did public hearings, collected a great deal of public information, designed new programs that we thought would best achieve the goals that we wanted to achieve. We have had temporary staff serving in some of these roles. In the state of Minnesota, you can only have temporary staff working with you for a year, and then you need to make the position permanent. And so now that we've got positions in place and we've got programs in place, we're ready to have some people come in who can take on those roles going forward. But yes, it is a workload issue, and it's also a service issue.
All right, thank you.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to say just another word about the advisory committees, and then I'll move on. We could not do our work if our statute did not allow us to bring in volunteer advisors. The workload would be impossible, even with 14 staff people. Our advisors are nominated or self-nominated or recruited. We bring in people who are knowledgeable in the arts but also understand how nonprofits work, understand how small businesses work. We generally use 7 to 10 people per committee, and any one grant program could have two committees or it could have 15 committees, depending on the number of applications. All of our meetings are open to the public. We follow the open meeting guidelines. Starting about 5 minutes ago, we have a advisory review committee going on in our office looking at applications from individual artists who are working in media arts. So all of the applicants are welcome to come in, listen to the conversation, hear the feedback on their proposal. We think it's one of the strengths of what we do. It's not done behind closed doors. We have a very strong conflict of interest policy. Both real and perceived conflicts of interest must be declared, and those members do not vote on those applications. These individuals serve for free. They do an amazing amount of work for us, and they are reimbursed for travel expenses, but they are not paid to be advisors with us. So that's just a snapshot of their role, that citizen role in our process. Finally, a little bit of information about the dollars themselves. The Arts Board has been funded through the general fund. I actually went back last night to about 1976, was as far as I could go online to look at the general appropriations lines. I've given you just about 12 or 15 years of funding. And you'll see that our general appropriation line has gone up and down, depending on resources that were available and things that were happening in the state. In 1998, you see a significant jump when Governor Carlson left office. He intentionally created a legacy in the arts. His legacy in the arts was to provide some additional funding for the Arts Board. We stayed at that level for a few years, and then those of you who were here at the legislature in 2003 remember I think it was a $4.6 billion deficit at the time that you wrestled with. Our cut at the time was about our appropriation was reduced by about a third at that point. We laid off half of our staff. We discontinued grant programs. We cut back very significantly. We inched back up a little bit in 2008, came back down in 2010. We think that this up and down motion is one of the reasons that many Minnesotans were interested in having the arts be a part of the legacy amendment, so that there would be a little bit more stability, a little bit more consistency in the kind of public funding that might be available. I'm going the wrong direction. This is what happened during this biennium with the addition of the legacy funds. Our general fund appropriation for fiscal 10 and 11 is about $17 million, and I'm speaking in round numbers. I hope that's appropriate. About $17 million for fiscal 10 and 11. The legacy fund appropriation for that same two-year period was about $43 million. We were the largest recipient of Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund dollars and are very grateful to have had that opportunity. I pulled 1 year of data just to show you how those dollars are spread out for fiscal 10. Fiscal 10 and 11 for us look almost exactly alike. There was a slight difference because of the supplemental budget for 11 that reduced our general fund appropriation. So this is our fiscal 10 dollars. You'll see that in all cases, we have had an appropriation that divides out what amount of the funds can be used by the Arts Board for grant programs and services, what can be used by the Regional Arts Councils, and what can be used by the Arts Board for operations and services, which in the legacy bill was called fiscal oversight and administration. Similar kinds of functions, different phrases that were used. You'll also see that the money that came to us from the legacy fund was broken out into the categories that are specified in the Constitution: arts and arts access, arts education, arts and cultural heritage. So we went from having a cumulative budget of about $8 million a year, $8.4 million a year, to having a cumulative budget of about $30 million for the arts. And it's been a significant difference for us. The Arts Board approved most of its first round of fiscal 10 grants last spring. We generally make grants for a one-year period of time, so we're just now starting to get reports back and data back about the impact of those. And as we come back through the spring, we'll be bringing you more information about the results that we're seeing.
Ms. Jens, we have a couple of questions, I think, on what you just covered. Representative Kahn?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Ms. Jens, maybe this is answered.
Excuse me, Representative Kahn, would you please use your mic?
Maybe this is answered by the chart on H21, but does the total cost of administering the legacy funds come from the legacy funds?
Ms. Jens?
In other words, when you said you were hiring new people and that was partially because of the need to have people to oversee the legacy funds, is that paid for by the legacy funds?
Ms. Jens?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, that's true. We have been able to add, or the new positions will be coming out of the administrative dollars that came to us through the legacy funds.
Okay, and Mr. Chairman, and as part of that administrative dollars from the legacy funds, do you also get to take a proportion of, your salary and whatever rent you pay and things like that? Well, the model that I'm thinking of is the model that we used to have when I was working on grants at the university, where besides the actual grant money to run the grant, there was also a proportion that went to overhead to the university. So do you get to charge that kind of overhead from the legacy fund against your regular budget too?
Ms. Jens?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, the state of Minnesota charges us an indirect cost rate, which I worked at the university as well, so I'm familiar with the concept. We pay a set of indirect costs to the state of Minnesota for shared services like Minnesota Management and Budget. We use the state's central accounting system. We're considered a small agency, obviously. Sure. A small agency within the state of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. When you think about some of the other state agencies. So we are able to use something called the Small Agency Resource Team. Mm-hmm. They help us with some of our putting our budget into the state's accounting system and helping us with that. We also take advantage of some human resources functions. When we posted the positions, they were posted centrally, and somebody at HR reviewed, did the first cut. So we do. There is indirect that goes to the state for that.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the thrust of my question, though, was do you get to take the proportional part of your budget that is the legacy budget from legacy funds for those expenses?
Ms. Jones.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, we're trying to be very, very careful to tie legacy expenses to legacy dollars, and things that had been funded in general fund continue to have them funded there. And that's based on the language in the Constitution that says we need to supplement.
Yes.
Rather than substitute for. So if we have been paying our rent out of general fund, we're still paying our rent out of general fund, and how we move forward on that will be one of the questions.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I guess the point that I'm making, again, using the model of granting to university systems, is that when your budget goes up as dramatically as it has in the legacy thing, I think it's appropriate to take that proportion of the legacy, that's not supplanting. What's happening is that you're using a certain amount to administer, you know, the legacy adds additional costs to your agency. Now, obviously, if your rent didn't go up, then there's no reason to do that. But certainly, any, obviously, additional computer costs, personnel costs, and so forth could all be attributed to the legacy. So I'm just, you know, and this may be something that every agency that's getting legacy money ought to do, is the question of the proportional increase of costs ought to be taken from the legacy funds.
Ms. Jones?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, one last comment, I think, about that. Administrative costs is an ongoing issue related to the legacy fund. Some of you may know that, and in fact, this afternoon I will be in the legacy funding division. We'll be talking about administrative costs. We've tried to be very careful to tie new costs to legacy dollars, and where there have been existing costs, have them stay where they are. We'll look, obviously, for guidance from the legislature going forward. The cap on the legacy funds was 2.5% could be used for administrative costs, which has been a challenge.
Well, should that, Mr. Chairman,
yep.
Again, that cap is not constitutional. That cap is statutory. Was it just done in the budget?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, that's true. That was part of the appropriations bill in 2009.
Well, that's something that might be looked at, is raising that cap. You know, I know that the numbers at the university were out of sight, and they were just a ripoff of the federal government. But the, and I also know that having gone from the federal government to a private agency, that they could be bargained down. But even the lowest number, I think from American Cancer Society, or maybe they took 10% or something like that, those numbers were much higher than 2.5%. So,
Ms. Jens, I think Representative Kahn raises a good point here. It seems to me that you've got, incrementally, you've got increased operational costs to be able to service the additional programs that are being funded through legacy, and the increment between your base operation and what you need to add in order to accommodate the growth in program, it seems to me, should be treated differently than your core basic costs relative to funding the State Arts Board. So, I guess I would echo what Representative Kahn has raised here in terms of an important question. Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jens, I was just want a little better, broader understanding of how do we compare to some of our surrounding states in terms of, you know, you get 30 million per year, approximately. How does that compare with Iowa, Illinois, Wisconsin, when you include the legacy funds and your core budget? Where do we stack up?
Ms. Jens?
Mr. Chair, Representative, Minnesota is far ahead of our neighbors in the upper Midwest. The legacy fund made the difference, and we now are funding the arts at a higher level than any of the states around us. And in fact, we're funding the arts at a higher level than many states in the country. And we're one of the worries that we have is that we are seeing many states that don't have the arts written into their constitution the way we do in Minnesota. And we're worried about what we see some of our colleagues facing in other states. And we're really pleased that Minnesotans care enough about the arts that they wanted to try to protect them, even during difficult economic times, and understanding the value that we can provide. And so we are doing much better than some other states at the moment.
Representative Stensrud.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, and just in as a relative dollars, I mean, are we two times more or five times more or just $1 million more?
Yes.
Compared to some of the other states?
Ms. Jans?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it would be better for me to give you better information. I don't really have the numbers around the surrounding states. I know that in Minnesota we're investing about $5 per person in the arts. And other states are much less than that, maybe $2 per person or even less than a dollar per person in the arts. And that's a per capita rating that we could get. We have that. We have access to that information from a national arts organization that provides that data for us.
Great. Thank you.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will touch very briefly on some of the ways that the dollars are being invested. Even if I had the rest of the morning, I couldn't cover all of them. So I will go very quickly, starting with the Arts Board. You'll see the breakout between how we're spending general fund dollars and how we're spending legacy fund dollars. There are two core things that we do with our general fund dollars. We provide grants to help stabilize and help our major arts organizations all across the state of Minnesota operate. We're funding about 150 or 160 of the most well-established arts organizations, the real heart of the nonprofit community in Minnesota. We also provide grants for individual artists who have projects that they want to do or have opportunities that will enhance their careers or their abilities to manage their businesses. What we did with the legacy dollars was to supplement that, to add some additional funding to those two core kinds of programs. And we invented seven brand new grant programs, all of them focused on providing Minnesotans greater access to the arts. Our goal, our outcomes for all of them are about more Minnesotans having a chance to engage in the arts. So we're funding touring. We have a program called Arts Access, not a great title, but it's about connecting arts organizations with underserved communities, whether that be communities based on racial or ethnic populations, whether that's communities of age, whether that's geographic communities. We have a program that funds human and social service organizations that want to bring the arts into their program mix. It's become one of our more popular programs because those are the people who have the fewest opportunities in the arts. We're providing professional development. I've mentioned that a little bit. Our arts learning program is our most popular program. It's lifelong learning in the arts, whether you're 3 or 103 and you want to learn in the arts. That's the place to come and suggest a project. We just finished a grant round. We had about just under $2 million available to award. We had $6 million worth of requests, so it is the most popular program we have. We're also funding community arts schools where classes for anybody, any age, any ability can go there and study. We're funding folk and traditional arts and festivals, community festivals, arts festivals throughout the state of Minnesota. So that's a snapshot of our grant programs. At the next slide, I highlighted just a few of the things that the regional arts councils are doing. Collectively, there are about 110 grant programs that are available throughout the state of Minnesota from the regional arts councils. And I've just selected a couple of them, just a very few of them. Obviously, support for arts and activities, ADA access and capital improvements. Many communities around the state of Minnesota have an arts facility that maybe needs some new lighting, maybe needs a ramp, so it's ADA accessible. So regional arts councils are doing that. A couple of the regional arts councils have created what they call legacy designation grants. They're grants to maybe a city government or a township government to involve artists or arts organizations in community planning. We see a lot of student mentorship programs at the regional arts council level, perhaps scholarships for high school students that would like to have a chance to expand their abilities in the arts. We also see a lot of artists in schools, residency programs at the regional level. Public art was one of the things that many of our regional arts councils heard of from their communities. They wanted a piece of sculpture or a work of art or something that would capture the identity of the community. So we see new public art programs happening around the state. And a number of the regional arts councils created very broad, they called them arts and cultural heritage grant programs, and they encouraged their constituents to come to them with the best ideas they could think of that would match the goals of the fund. And so we're seeing a real variety of activities. And again, as those programs, that first year of programs play out, we'll have more information to bring back to you at a later date. On the next slide, I gave you a web link to the report that we provided to the legislature in January that outlines specifically all of our Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund investments for Fiscal 10. It's a 70-80-page report, and so that will have more detail than I could cover in a session like this. And finally, one last snapshot about Fiscal 10 versus Fiscal 9, and I'm sorry we didn't put Fiscal 9 on the slide, but I'll give you the numbers. You see that collectively, we and the Regional Arts Councils together received about 3,500 requests for grants. We were able to award about 2,200 of those grants. looking at the Arts Board line, you'll see that we had nearly 1,500 requests. The year before, we had just over 600. So the increase in grant requests was 130%, which goes back to the question earlier about needing administrative staff or needing program staff to help with that. Our grant making went up 70%. We were able to increase our grants by 70%. The Regional Arts Council level, the increase in requests was about 65% from 1,200 to 2,000 requests. And so, again, collectively as a system, we saw a significant increase in the kinds of ideas, the kinds of projects, the kinds of programs that really would like to take advantage of public funding. And last, not last year, 2 years ago, when the first appropriations were made and we were out having public forums, we said to everyone in Minnesota, dream big. This is a chance to think about all sorts of new ways that the arts can play a life in play a role in the lives of our communities, in the roles of our state, and we're seeing that starting to happen now. The last thing I'll say, I know that this committee will be dealing both with our general fund appropriation and with the legacy funds. I think the one last thing I would want to say is that we are so what's the right adjective? We're honored, we're thrilled, we're pleased that Minnesotans cared enough about the arts to put them in the state constitution. We think that protects them in ways that we're not seeing them protected in some other states. The arts are a part of building the imagination, the identity, the economic success, the creative future that we want in Minnesota. And we're really very honored and very humbled by the responsibility we've had in playing a role in stewarding those dollars. We appreciate the support we've had, both from the general fund and from the new legacy funds. We look forward to continuing to play that role. We think we've had a strong track record. People have felt that we're accountable and we're transparent, and we involve Minnesotans in our process. And so we look forward to continuing to inform you about what we're doing, and hope that support from the state of Minnesota will continue to be strong.
Well, thank you, Ms. Jens. We have three members who have additional questions, and we've got about 3 minutes. So, Representative Kahn.
Maybe it's in that report that you cited, and I'll look. But do you list the festivals that you supported? Is there a list of those?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, the list of grantees is not in the report, but it is on our website.
So the list of, I can specifically look for festivals.
You can look specifically for any of the grant programs. You can see a list on our website of the organization that was funded, the amount, and the community that it's in.
I'm specifically interested in the issue of festivals, though. Can I find that as a subheading?
Yes, okay. Mr. Chair, thank Representative Kahn, you can. You will find a Minnesota Festival Support in the list of grantees.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jens, you're talking about the grants, and I'm just wondering, what is the criteria for a person, if they've gotten a grant through the Arts Board, can they apply again, say, in another year or 2 years, or is it a one-time deal for getting a grant from the Arts Board to do their deal? And then what are the results of your grants as far as what do you see as far as people who have gotten a grant? What are the results as far as have they created a business, and have they gone forward and expanded to the point of becoming, adding jobs to the economy and things like that? Just kind of results, kind of a guy looking for the bottom line here.
Ms. Jans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, organizations and individuals can apply year after year for funding. All of our grant programs are competitive, so they are not guaranteed funding year after year. And we look for not only sound artistic skills and artistic qualities, but we also look for the way a project might be managed, or a way an organization is managed. Is it financially and managerially sound? We look for service to the state. We don't fund things just for the sake of funding them, but we look for community impact. We look for ways that maybe a project is involving young people or involving senior citizens. We allow our grantees to define their own outcomes. Those outcomes are almost always based on the way that Minnesotans are being served with the funds. With individual artists, which is a slightly different project, we do look at what will the grant do for them as an artist, but also as an individual business? Will it give them some infrastructure so that they can market themselves and become more successful, generate more income? Will it allow them to reach new audiences that they have not yet reached before? And so the outcomes are all based on what the project is and what it's meant to do. Now, given the legacy funds and the requirement that there be measurable goals and outcomes, we're asking for that in a new way, and we will be tracking that in a new way. And so we'll have some additional data to bring back to you as those first year of grants end.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Ms. Jens, you don't track the results of your grants that you give out as far as what the results are, as far as their success or the fact that they can reapply and reapply and reapply. Tells me that they may not have been able to get off first base on the first time, but on the second time, they might get off on the first base, but maybe not the second base, and they can apply again. And you don't know what. All you know is that they've gotten grants and they are happy.
Ms. Jans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think I gave you a wrong impression. They do give us a final report. They have given us a final report always. Uh-huh. Did they achieve their goals? Did they reach the individuals that they wanted to reach? Did they accomplish the goals that they set for themselves or for their organizations? So we do have that information. What we will be doing going forward is to be looking at a broader set of outcomes that relate to the way Minnesotans are being served, and we're going to be following that over time in a new way and being able to track the outcomes in different ways. The outcomes may not always be specifically related to economics. Pardon me, and you mentioned job creation. In some cases, that may be the goal of the project. In some cases, it may not be. It may simply be that it's a program that has been, I'll make up an example, it's a program that has been serving young people who are school-aged, and now the goal is to start to engage young people who are pre-K, because we know that the arts in that very young sort of 3, 4, 5, 6-year-old range have a huge impact. So it's often much more about what will the impact be on the individual or the group of people who are being served, rather than specifically about the economics. But we're going to continue to increase our ability to track that data, to follow the data. We're also going to be building in a mechanism to take previous performance on a grant into account when we award future grants. So we're going to be doing some things in some new ways.
The 3 minutes are up, but I will accept a quick question or comment from Representative Downey and then Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll ask the question. It may warrant a longer answer, and if it does, we can just do that offline. And I'm not on the committee that really oversees the grants and the substance of what you do, but an observation and maybe a concern is that if after 20 years we've blown through $600 million in these program areas, will we have anything that's lasting and sustainable? And maybe a specific question, are we allocating a portion of these grants to endowments or other kind of repetitive things, or is all of this just going to be expended and then we'll be sitting here in 20 years probably with operational cost streams for some of what we've built and some interesting artifacts, but something that isn't sustainable, let's say, for a 50-year horizon?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Jans?
Mr. Chair, Representative Downey, right now the Arts Board is not using public funds for building investments or building cash reserves. It's not something that those public dollars have seemed well suited to do. Now, it may be over time something we want to consider. The investment that we see long-term is a couple of things. One of them is stronger, healthier arts organizations and artists who then have the capacity to continue to do work that's meaningful, to do work that continues to engage Minnesotans. In many ways, our long-term goal was that vision that you saw, that more and more Minnesotans have the chance to be impacted by the arts, whether that's directly as a participant or as a spectator, or impacted by the economic activity or the other benefits that come from it. And so the impacts will be different kinds of impacts. And one of the things that we struggle with, quite frankly, is how do you measure all of those? How do you measure community development? How do you measure the long-term impact of a young person who gets to study the arts when they're 3 or 4 years old, and what difference that makes when they're an adult, and the kind of career they might choose or the kind of business they might found? It's a little daunting, but we certainly are going to focus more and more on what are the outcomes that are provable, what is the evidence that we can provide so that we see a lasting legacy in Minnesota.
Representative Gunther, and then we're moving on.
Real quick one, you mentioned that arts is tourism, and I totally agree with that concept. Do you partner at all with Explore Minnesota Tourism in any way, and if you don't, why not?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Jans?
Representative Gunther, we do collaborate with Explore Minnesota Tourism. We will be able to work with them more now, we hope. Often when we would collaborate with them, we could bring time but no money. And now we may have some opportunities to do that. Most of what we have done to date has been in training and helping people around the state understand how to market, how to package, how to promote cultural heritage tourism, which is growing in the country. And it's not just arts, but it's also the historic sites. It's a way to build in the hospitality industry. It's bringing all of those forces that have the same common interest together in a way that maximizes their potential. So we have worked with Explore Minnesota Tourism on a number of projects. We'll look forward to continuing to do that.
Legacy Division Chair Erdahl has requested some opportunity to give some important information.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real briefly, everything I say is important information, not just this stuff. But we're developing a template in the Legacy Committee with the help of the Legislative Auditor. And, of course, it's very important to know where the money is going. And we are attempting to develop, a template that will consistently track the money through the entire process with the Arts Board, for example, where they disperse it to, and then once it is dispersed to the local councils, who they give it to and how it's spent. So I'm hoping in the future, in the next funding cycle, that we'll be able to easily access the public and members both through the website where the money goes.
Thank you, Representative Erdahl, and thank you, Ms. Jens. We will have you back here before long talking about the budget for the next biennium. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members of the committee.
We're reorganizing the agenda, and we're going to do the workforce report next. Ms. Plant, would you please come forward? And while she's doing that, would someone move the minutes from yesterday?
So moved.
Who was it? Gauthier moved. Any additions or corrections? All in favor of those minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. The minutes are approved. Welcome, Ms. Plant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Judy Plant, Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. And I've been asked today to present to you on our workforce report. This is a report that the
former Department of Employee Relations began putting together in the early 2000s. It's not a required report in terms of a legislative mandate, but rather was in response to any number of repeated questions that that department received about the workforce. And so this report was the compilation of that. It was put together a number of years in a row. There was a gap year in 2009 as Dewar and Finance merged into MMB. And as we reconsidered some of the data that was being used in the report, as we looked at it as a merged agency, one of the things that we realized is past reports had information that was inconsistent. As you may be aware, there are various definitions of the executive branch across various pieces of statute. And our report had some interesting inconsistencies. Some parts would include MNSCU, some would not. Some would be on fiscal year, some would be on calendar year. It was very confusing, and it was leading people to draw some conclusions that were inaccurate based on that. So we took a year's hiatus and came back this year with this finished report. So that's our background on where we're at. What I would like to do is just walk you through some of the highlights of the report and then entertain your questions as we get towards the end. If you'll turn to page 6 in your copy, this handy-dandy chart I have is not going to show up on our overheads here, but you'll see a chart here that looks, it's table A, workforce, state workforce at a glance. I am told by many people who use this report that this is the single page that they turn to because it's got the quick thumbnail of information. Again, I want to remind you that this is based on a fiscal year, and it's regarding information for state executive branch agencies. So again, it does not include MNSCU. It does not include the state-operated function of the courts. Some other figures that you have, including the FTE reports from the Budget Division, do include some of they include the courts in that particular number. So this document is consistent from beginning to end in that it's the state executive branch agencies only, and it's for fiscal year 10, ending June 30th, okay? So you can see here that we do have information on both appointment counts and FTEs, and I'll get into all of these issues in more detail as we go through the report. The median age of our workforce is 50.5. Big surprise, none of us, of course, are getting older, but people in the workforce are. And collectively, the age of state employees is rising, much to do with the retention of people as they go through their career, and also with a rather interesting turnover that we have with people in jobs of 4 years and less. We're about at 50% female these days. Our minority representation is at 8.04%. However, that's a voluntarily reported number, so we know it's at least 8.4%, but we're not sure if it might be just a little higher since that's a voluntary reporting issue. We also have representatives of the veteran population at 12.11%. That is considerably above the Minnesota of percentage of veterans of workforce age 18 to 64. They are represented in that population at 7%. And we are currently, in terms of new hires, hiring at 7.43%. So that veteran number really does reflect, we believe, the large number of Vietnam-era veterans who joined the state workforce largely in technology jobs following that particular era. So that's our overview page, and as we move forward...
Before you move on, Representative Kahn had a question.
Yes.
Yes, one of the things we continually hear is that the state should be more like a business, and we should operate, treat our workforce more like a business. One of the things that that we note is that the state not only doesn't give domestic partner benefits to its own employees, but also forbids local units of government from doing that, and that and state the entities like Minsky, while every single big business in the state does it. Is there anything we can learn for that, or is that anything that you did in the workforce survey in terms of retention on hiring, particularly people in the craft areas and technology areas?
Well, even though that doesn't relate to your chart on page 6, you may respond.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, in this particular report, this does not survey employees for their reasons for coming to the state of Minnesota as employees or their reasons for leaving. We don't have the best of data in terms of the people that are attracted to state employment or the reasons why they leave. So I would wonder about that question, but I don't have an answer for it.
You may proceed.
Great. So moving along, I'd like to actually ask you to move to page 8. And this is one of the areas where pages 8 and 9, we talk about the number of state employees, always a topic of interest. And it's one of the areas where the merger of the former Department of Employee Relations and Department of Finance has been very beneficial. You may not have been aware, but for many years there's been a little squabbling over the interpretation of how many people do we have in the state of Minnesota as employees. And the Department of Employee Relations always used an appointment count, a head count, literally. And for budget reasons, the Department of Finance used FTEs because that's where the dollar impact is. We've come to the resolution that both methods have their merits, and so our report now contains both pieces of information. I'd like to take just the January appointment counts. We look at our counts one day in January and one day in July. As you can imagine, in an organization as large as the state of Minnesota, we have a great deal of flux of people coming and going. We have seasonal jobs. They don't all fall in the same season. Revenue, tax, seasonal workers come at a different time than the DNR seasonal workers. There's the MnDOT folks who work on the roads in the summer, but then there are the snowplow drivers. So we have different ebbs and flows. Historically, January tends to be a low point. Historically, July tends to be the high point. So we take a measure once in January, once in July, so we can do a year-to-year comparison. It's a rough estimate because, again, headcount being exact every single day is a little bit different. And as you can see, your chart on page 8 contains both calendar year and fiscal year. It's actually the January and July counts. That's what that should say. And the darker colored line is the January count, which is the chart I've got up on your screen. And you can see that we range in that January count from 33,251 in 2001 to 33,090 in 2010. Those were the January counts. I know that we don't have an official number for this year yet, but we were down some in December when I was keeping an eye on this to 32,799. So we've been floating in that 32,500 to 33,000 range on average. Now, we also look at our July appointment count, and again, this tends to be the peak when we have grain inspectors and parks workers and all sorts of people doing road work. And again, you can see that our July numbers, slight dips there in the 2003 and 4 years, but it's remained fairly constant. You can also see that even though there is sort of a common language about the increase in state government, the numbers in terms of headcount in both January and July have remained relatively constant. We also need to be clear that we do have some increases and decreases in particular agencies over those 10 years' time. And some of the agencies that have decreased over that time, the admin, OET, and finance areas are down about 155. MnDOT was down about 400. Education down about 98. The areas that increased over that 10 years' time include veterans up about 204, corrections up about 360, revenue up about 360. So you can just see that reflects some of the policy decisions that have been made at the legislative level being carried out at the agency level. If you turn to page 9, we look at FTEs. Now, those of you who are familiar with the budget presentations that are done, and Mr. Bielik typically presents on FTEs, and some of you may have used his FTE charts on the MMB website. That FTE website does include some state courts positions that we are not reflecting here because they're not part of the executive branch. So this is a subset of his numbers. And again, you can see that the FTEs, 32,607 in 2001, 32,786 in 2010. Our average over 10 years, 31,900. So there's fluctuation, but it's not drastic.
Ms. Plant, yes. Both of these charts would kind of fly in the face of conventional wisdom, where because of all the budget difficulties the state has had in the last 8 to 10 years, people would, I think, be very surprised to see how flat our FTE counts and employee counts are. How would you explain that?
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that I can speak for the budget side of our organization. I do believe that it's easy to look at the overall size of government and say it's large, therefore it must be growing. This is the data. The data says it really has been staying relatively constant. So clearly there are other costs involved, and there certainly are increases in pay during that time that increase total compensation. That's one way to look at it. But the actual numbers of people that have been employed, whether you count it via FTEs or appointments, has stayed relatively stable. We also, just for reference, if you look at some historical data, we have 71 state workers per 10,000. That was a quote based on, I believe, 2009 numbers. And that is about the 10th leanest in the country, according to one of our media sources. In 1979, the Department of Finance did a report on the number of FTEs per 10,000, and at that time it was 72. So in terms of our relationship to population in Minnesota, again, by that measure, we have stayed fairly constant. So it's tempting to say it's due to the growth of the number of state employees, and that's not the case.
Well, it seems to me that this data does not illustrate the budget difficulties we've had, because the costs have gone up, the wages have gone up, and yet our numbers are about the same in spite of the fact that we've had budget shortfalls going back the last 8 to 10 years. I think most people would find this very surprising. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Plant, the last thing that you said, 71 state employees per 10,000 population?
Yes.
How do you compare, like, the number of state employees to the private workforce? How do we compare that way?
Ms. Plant?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm looking at my list of comparisons, and what I have is not going to answer your question. What I have is information on there are a number of sources that rank how we compare to other states. The 2009 annual survey of state and local government says we're 39th in the country. Their number is 67.9 per 10,000 residents. The 2007 census is the one that indicates we're 69 per 10,000. I mean, depending on your slice of time, you get a slightly different reading. And in that ranking, we're 42nd in the nation. When we look at all public employees, state and local. I think that's what the Minnesota Taxpayers Association looked at. That looks at all public employment, and we're 39th in the nation. So comparing to other states, not addressing the specific question that you had. Government employment as a percent of non-farm employment in the state is at 15.2, and that's 38th in the nation. So I'm trying to give you some relative sense of where we are without being able to answer your specific question.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Anderson.
Ms. Plant, is there data out there that shows the relationship between the number of state employees to the private workforce?
Ms. Plant?
Mr. Chair, Representative...
And not population, but workforce.
I will check to see if there's information. I'm pretty sure there is, and I'm also sure I don't have it with me, so we'll get that for you.
Thank you.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious, on the deed website, they have some pretty detailed tables, and they show monthly statistics and then average it. And it seems to roughly correlate to your appointment data. Do you know, does deed count by appointment versus FTE when you look at their summary statistics?
Ms. Plant?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe theirs is by appointment, but I would have to check to make sure.
Representative Winkler.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Plant, I thought I just heard you say that in Minnesota, 15% of the non-farm workforce is in government?
Correct.
Ms. Plant?
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes. 15.2%, and again, that's from Bureau of Labor Statistics 2007-08, and they rate us as 38th in the nation at that rate.
Representative Winkler.
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I think that actually is the statistic that you were looking for. If our workforce is 15% of the total state workforce, non-farm workforce, that ranks us 38th in the country. It seems to me that is the answer that you were looking for. I thought I heard it. I just wanted to make sure that that was clear.
You may proceed.
Thank you. All right, if you'd proceed to page 10. And just so you can see the distribution, this will not come as any surprise to you.
Say, Ms. Plant, I think the page numbers you're giving are giving are different from what we have. 10 was the slide that we had looked at previously. So,
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know who did it, but my book came with crib notes. And this is real helpful if somebody wants
That's
to.
Fine.
Well, why was it over here?
I thought you talked to snap the copy up of other people's papers.
Well, yeah, but I was wondering about these nasty editorial comments about legislators in here. I knew it must have been yours.
They're all about you.
Okay.
Can we switch?
Was this yours?
Yeah.
Ms. Plant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, I believe we are on page 11, and thank you for that correction. The chart simply shows the distribution of employees over the state executive branch workforce. And as you can see, with no surprise, the Department of Human Services comes in at the highest number, followed by Transportation and Corrections, and then going up the outer side here with the next smallest agencies. The rather large red blob of 18% is all other agencies that are smaller than pollution control at 927. So it's not a surprise to anyone who's worked on the budgets and has looked at those numbers as you have. To some of our general public who look at this information, they are sometimes surprised to see the distribution of state employees. The report itself has details about each department with their FTE headcount. This will be on your page 12. FTE headcount, percent of the current workforce, and change in headcount since fiscal 9. So you just have some comparative data by agency. And we also, on page 13, make sure I've got the right pages, have a map of distribution of executive branch employees. Now, this is different. If you've seen a map in previous reports, those maps included the Minsky schools, and so obviously there were larger numbers everywhere that there's a Minsky facility. This reflects just executive branch agencies. Next, if we could move to page 15, and this deals with diversity and our profile. And again, most of these items, except for age, ethnic minority persons with disability, gender, veterans with disability, and veterans, are voluntarily reported. We think the one on gender is fairly accurate. The others may be underreported. And also, we have that astounding figure of age 40 and over at 71.7% on the chart that's on your page. This particular graphic shows the ethnic background of our workforce. We are somewhat below the representation of minorities in the general population. So that's an area of concern for us in the future. On page 15, we begin to talk about the increasing median age of the workforce. I'm just going to show the graphic you're looking at, and you can see it better on your sheet, obviously. This is a little diagram that is difficult to read, but rather fun when you look at the details. It's the age blip in each one of the agencies, and it's a great illustration that shows the challenges being faced in each agency as we look at workforce planning. And this is one of the things, I know that there's a common conversation of we'd like more state employees to be gone. My concern is looking a number of years out and saying, and when they're gone, and when there is still priority work to be done, who will we have come in to do that work? And looking at the age distribution, that provides us the opportunity to work with agencies on their workforce planning concerns. To illustrate that, I have a couple of things that are not in your report, but that I use for other presentations. The first is this graphic. The blue portion represents workers ages 20 through 39, and they are just 27% of our workforce. The red represents what I like to say is the prime of life, since I'm right in it, ages 40 to 59, and that is 61% of our workforce. This is not in your report, so I'll get you a copy separately. And then there's the distribution age 60 and above, which is 12%. So you can see we are not a young workforce. We are a seasoned is the word I prefer to use for myself, seasoned workforce. But that is one of the challenges that we have. It also is reflective of the kind of work that we hire for. Yes, there are the folks who work on the roads in the summer and do some of the manual labor and things, but generally our work tends to be more white collar, more requiring of higher education, more requiring of years of experience. And so when we do comparisons with the general distribution of work in the state's workforce versus the executive branch and what we hire for, it's not surprising that we have people who are a little older when they both come to the state as well as that they are staying longer. And I'm sure that Dr. Gillespie is here, and he will recognize this chart because it's his, just as an illustration. He's been charting the workforce, the aging of the workforce, and you can see a succession of blips here. This was our peak in 84, this was our peak in 94, this was our peak in 2000, and here we are in 2010. So you can literally watch the bulge going through the python as we age out. All right. And how this plays out for us as a workforce planning issue. This little chart shows the age distribution of people who do accounting for the state. We have different bars for clerical and technical, professional and supervisory. This very small number is 20 to 29. This is 39 to that should say 30 to 39. Our largest two areas are 40 to 49, 50 to 54. So we have a 15-year time span here, 55 to 59, 60 to 64, and 65 and older. So you can see that we have a definitely middle-aged approach to our accounting. And while it's not an issue at the moment, it will be an issue in the future as these people start to age out or find other jobs in other places. And as they do, we'll be looking at the younger workforce to come in. And we can already tell you that there's great competition for entry-level trained accounting personnel, to the point that one of the large accounting firms is offering full-ride scholarships and full-time jobs to students who will promise to study accounting and stay with them for a number of years after graduation. That will be our competition for attracting talent in the future. So as an employer, we have some interesting things to face because of the increasing median age of our workforce. And again, we're at 50.5 with that. Which leads us to another question, which is about retirement. In your
Ms. Platt, before you move forward, Representative Banyan had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Platt, what I wanted to ask about is you've got this increasing age, and I liked your pie chart that you started with when you kind of took us away from our report and into some additional data. Can you characterize, do you have any idea what that pie chart would have looked like in 2000?
My intuition, without data, would say that the blue section would be just slightly larger.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Plant, is it reasonable to think that perhaps one reason for the increasing size of our payroll when we don't have an expanding employment period is just the fact that older workers tend to make more? I mean, I have to say, I learned that I didn't make any real money till I turned 40. Is that in fact perhaps what's going on here? Do we have some statement on the average wage of these individuals versus the level of our employment over the last several years? And is that just because we just have a workforce that's older and older folks just make more?
Ms. Plant?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that's a factor. I don't think it totally accounts for it. Certainly, there is an element that folks who have been with the state for a period of time have come up the ranks to the max of their salary range, and that has an impact. But that would be also offset by the fact that many of them are at max in their salary range, and in years where there are zero settlements, they get no increase at all. So where younger people might continue to get one.
Well, I wasn't going to follow up, but now I will because you brought something into this. If the average duration of someone working in the state is about 12 and 13 years, at what point do they reach that maximum usually? Is it within the 12, or is it for folks that get well past 12? At what point do we cap them out and say you've hit the top of your ladder?
Ms. Plant?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd have to take a good look at the contracts to determine how long it would take someone to reach that age. I would not want to hazard a guess without taking a second look.
Ms. Plant, will you be able to wrap up in the next few minutes?
Sure.
Since we do have another group that is going to be presenting yet before we conclude today.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I will do my best. The next area is retirement. On page 19, you have a total retirements by year. This reflects a slight dip in 2009 because of the economy dipping. Some people's portfolios went south. They decided not to retire. We did have the early retirement incentive that took effect July 1st, so it's not reflected in these numbers. Our unofficial tally on that is that about 990 people will have retired because of the early retirement incentive. One of the challenges with retirement is that the average age of our managers is 54, and our supervisors is 53. right now that's not an issue. In 10 years' time, we will be looking at a leadership void if we are not prepared for that. And this chart that you will find on page 20 shows the average age of retirement creeping up ever so slightly. From 2001, it was at 60.2, and in 2010, it's at 61.3. So people are sticking around longer.
Is there a question on that point, Representative Benson?
Nice. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a simple question. It may be one for agency managers or directors rather than you, ma'am. So, but just a question, maybe you know. Do we have succession plans? I mean, if looking at the aging of the executives, managers, supervisors, one thing that seemed prudent, very prudent, in fact, would begin to identify people with the skills and knowledges and abilities to fill those positions, and we begin a process to train them in. Is it your understanding we do?
Ms. Plant?
Mr. Chair, Representative, agencies were required to do workforce planning several years ago, and as part of that, to identify areas where they would need to do succession planning, and to identify particular people and move them forward. There's some complication in that the way that we do fill positions is on a merit system, and so you can't necessarily handpick a successor and raise them up. But we have looked at ways that we can raise the entire boat by training a cohort of leaders. We also are, our area is working with agencies to identify pivotal positions, a little different than saying every vacancy, rather saying those absolutely pivotal ones that make the wheels turn in each of our organizations, how are we doing for backup planning for those individuals. I won't say that it's perfect, and it is actually an ongoing art form of assessing on a regular basis where do we see the next gap, but they are agencies are aware of that.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Plant. It was recently brought to my attention that by a constituent that works in a department that is unable to get the buyout or the early retirement. So is there cases where some departments you're able to get it and others you aren't able to? So how are we managing that? So across the board, I suppose you could lose a whole, I think this person worked in public safety, I think, and is a little disappointed because they have peers that are have served less time than themselves but don't have that available to them. Is that correct? And what is the fairness, or how do we work that out?
Ms. Plant?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we did ask agencies to look carefully at business needs as part of their planning for the early retirement incentive, and also as well as the fiscal impact of the retirements. What would they use this tool for from a good business management perspective, as well as, of course, we knew that many employees were interested in pursuing early retirement. We do have sort of a possible nightmare scenario of all of the top experienced talent in a given field exiting at the same time if it's a wide-open offering. And so there were some cases, I'm sure, where people who would like to have taken it were not offered. We can get you more information on the early retirement program and the instructions that we gave to agencies. We have a report that is due to your body in April, and we'll have more detail on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Plant.
Ms. Plant, proceed, hope we can finish up here in a few minutes.
I'm working. I believe on page 21 we're talking about turnover rates. The key thing that I'd like to point out there, we had total resignations. Those are people who left not because their jobs ended or they were asked to leave in some way or they were on a temporary job, but people who were in long-term permanent jobs who chose to leave. The resignations of 1,200, that alone is not a startling statistic. What was interesting to us is that we looked at the number of resignations by years of service. And if you look at the first two bars, the blue and orange bars in each of these years, 2005 to 2010, those are people who have served with state government for less than 4 years. So the majority of people who are leaving in that first 4 years. Again, while we have a stable workforce, that's not an issue. As boomers do start to finally retire, we are losing people at the front end, so we won't have them coming up through the system, and that's a concern for us in workforce planning. I know also that there's a lot of interest in hiring, so I'll skip to page 23. I believe I have the right page number. And this is looking at the hiring experience over the last 10 years. The black line on your chart is the trend line, and the blue line is our actual new hires, new people off the street. And you can see that the number of new hires decreased. And you know that we have jobs that cannot stay vacant. They're things where providing medical or custodial care to people, public health and safety, law enforcement, care of prisoners, there's any number of things that just need to be done. There are pieces of work that the legislature has said need to be the work of state government. And as those positions vacate, that's what we're filling. But you can see the hiring activity does reflect a general slowdown during that time. And all right. I think the final page that most people find of interest is of significant interest. All of it, of course, compelling, but is on page 28, which is on total compensation. And I'm not going to go into great detail. We do have a total comp report that's on our department website, and there are a number of people who can speak more eloquently to the details than I can. We simply have the total compensation numbers and numbers on the amount of overtime paid. And it's interesting to me that the overtime paid has been reduced in 2010 fiscal year to the same level as 2007, which to me would indicate some increased level of scrutiny and control within state agencies. And I believe I can end the presentation there. There's, of course, lots more we could talk about, and will if you have questions.
Yeah. Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and hopefully this is a quick question. On the bottom of your page 21, you have total resignations and total layoffs. And I guess my question is that separate and distinct from the retirement numbers? So if you wanted to come up with some kind of a total attrition number, you'd add those two numbers plus retirements?
Ms. Plant?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I believe that the total resignations would include retirements. I can verify that. And I would also caution you in looking at the layoff number. That is the number that reflects the number of layoffs that played out to people actually going out on the street. As you know, when a layoff occurs within an agency, sometimes there's that whole bumping chain and people land in different jobs. Those don't show up in this data as layoffs.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quick question. Thanks for your testimony. On page 28, the last one we looked at here, the narrative section beneath the first table says that some of the increase in total compensation is due to the rising cost of employer-paid health insurance benefits plus mandated extra contributions for pensions. And then there's a web link that's referenced there. Is that the place we could go to find out how much of that increase might be due to those factors, or wouldn't that information be there? And if it isn't, could you talk about
it? Mr. Chair, Representative, I do believe that is the place to go for that information.
Well, Ms. Plant, thank you very much. That's a very informative report, and appreciate your being here to go through it. And I'm sure that members will have additional questions. They know how to get a hold of you to further ask those questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We will now move to the Historical Society. And members, it looks like March 8th is going to be the best date, if that's okay with everyone. And it probably would be well for us to plan to go over to the History Center late afternoon, maybe 5:30, something like that. And I understand it will take about an hour and a half to do the kind of tour that we ought to be doing. And so if you would please put that on your calendar. And Representative Murphy,
Mr. Chair, what day is that?
That's a Tuesday, March 8th. Pardon me?
What time? Evening?
Yeah, evening. Yeah. Yeah, we're talking about probably 5 or 5:30 would be the best time.
That's great.
We'll confirm that by email here. And if anybody's got schedule problems that would influence that start time, let me know. Mr. Fox, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michael Fox. I'm director of the Minnesota Historical Society. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to provide an overview of the programs and activities of the society. Since we are new to this committee, and there are some new faces around this table as well as familiar ones, my task today is to let you know a little bit about who we are and what we do. Of course, you already know if you visited one of our historic sites in northeastern Minnesota, Split Rock Lighthouse, the Forest History Center, in northwestern Minnesota at the Comstock House, or historic Fort Snelling here in the metro. If you've enjoyed the Minnesota's Greatest Generation exhibit at the History Center, an exhibit that honors the generation of Minnesotans who lived through the Great Depression, fought World War II, and brought America to the post-war economic prosperity that we enjoyed. You know us if someone in your family has consulted our website for information to do family history research. You know us if your children or grandchildren have toured the Capitol or have studied Minnesota history using our Northern Lights textbook. Or you probably have encountered the Society and its work in a dozen other ways and in venues across the state. Given the time, I want to focus my attention on the programs of the Society and leave the budget issues to a later date that I've been told we will have an opportunity to make a presentation to that. Is that correct, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, you will. Yep.
Thank you. And we look forward to your visit at the History Center on March 8th, where you can get an opportunity to see firsthand a little bit of what we do. And since I know the committee is very interested in how organizations with state funding are doing business differently, I want to make sure that you have a few minutes to touch on innovation, to talk about the ways in which the Historical Society is doing its work and ways which we think are more efficient and effective. The Society is certainly a different organization than one that I joined 24 years ago. You have, I hope, before you a copy of the printouts of the PowerPoint that Mr. Kelleher is going to put on the screen at any moment. So first, who are we? Well, we're a little different from many of the agencies and organizations that will come before this committee. The Minnesota Historical Society is a statewide organization created and operated under a charter granted by the territorial legislature in 1849, 9 years before Minnesota's statehood. That's correct. The Society is older than the state of Minnesota. We're a nonprofit organization that has benefited from state support continuously since 1856. We are, in fact, the oldest public-private partnership in the state. And the flexibility of what is described in statute as our semi-state status enables us to maximize the impact of support from both public and private sources. We are governed by an executive council as a membership organization. The council is elected by our 20,000 members statewide. We are certainly the largest historical membership organization in the country. Minnesotans appreciate and support their history and have for over 160 years. MHS is not a strategic, a static institution, I should say. We're an organization that responds to the times. And in 2010, our executive council led us through a strategic planning process that gave us three new directions. First, that we would focus and concentrate our work as an educational institution on four specific audiences: students, teachers, parents, with an emphasis on grades 4 to 12, adults over 50, families with children, and young adults. Second, that we would make greater use of technology to expand the reach of our programs. And third, that we would engage in partnerships to maximize the effectiveness of our programs and resources. We strive to illuminate the past to light the future, as we say. Our mission statement says that we help people gain perspective on their lives by understanding their history. It's my firm conviction that if you don't know where you came from, how can you understand where you are today and make firm decisions about where you're going forward into the future? I would argue that knowing and understanding our history is all the more important in these difficult economic times, that our actions and decisions be firmly grounded and that knowledge and understanding. It's that conviction that leads to the tag that you often see from the Historical Society, the button on my lapel that says, "History matters." And we believe history matters exactly for those reasons. That understanding the past is part of a lifelong learning experience that's essential to good civic engagement, to our lives as active participants in the civic process. And that happens at every age, whether we're talking about students in school, families with young children imparting values and experiences, or more mature adults, a phase in which I find myself in. The Society's legislative charter identified the key functions the Society performed on behalf of the citizens of Minnesota. We preserve the evidence of the past, which is the basis for all historical knowledge and understanding. And we inform and educate Minnesotans of all ages. The Society offers a range of programs. People engage with history in different ways. Some people like to enjoy the exhibits and living history programs at our sites and museums. Others enjoy doing their own research into family or community history. Others like to read about the past in the books we publish. For students, obviously, history is a subject for learning in school. Our Historic Sites Network is really the backbone, a network of 26 sites and museums around the state. It's really the backbone of our educational programs. It's where students and teachers come to engage in educational programs on a daily basis. And of course, we are an important element, and our sites are an important element in the state's tourism economy. And yes, to anticipate the question, we do work actively and are on the Advisory Council of Explore Minnesota to promote history and cultural tourism in the state. The Society also preserves the record of the past in many forms. In this slide, these statistics illustrate the scope, breadth, and range of our resources. But we don't preserve the stuff simply to keep it. The Society is not grandma's attic where old stuff is kept for dead storage. These research resources are the basis of what we know about the past. They're the basis for research by students and adults. We use them to develop our exhibits and programs. They are accessible at the History Center, and as more and more collections are digitized, increasingly over the web. The Society reaches many Minnesotans. I can't read the slides there with my glasses in these days. We serve over 600,000 visitors to our historic sites, 250,000 visitors to the History Center annually. And in that group are 225,000 school children who are coming as part of organized school trips. This is not kids coming with their families or their parents or their grandparents. This is just the educational group. Each year we serve 1 in 5 Minnesotans in person. Additionally, we have about 2 million unique visitors to our website each year. Let me find my place here. A few other examples of performance measures that we pay attention to. We have 28,000 school kids in middle and high school who participate in History Day. History Day is an involved program where kids do research and create presentations at the school, regional, state, and national level. Videos, research reports, skits and playlets, websites, etc. These are things that improve their research skills, improve their knowledge about the past, and they improve their communication skills, because an important part of this is communicating the results of that research to others. The Society makes use of volunteers. We had over 42,000 hours of volunteer service. That's the equivalent of 20 FTEs. Has an economic benefit to the Society of over $1 million of donated services each year. The Northern Lights History curriculum I mentioned, 60,000, David will hold the book up if you haven't seen it, maybe we'll pass it around. Over 60,000 sixth graders study history, Minnesota history in the sixth grade using this textbook. And the slide that you see shows the distribution of its adoption in school districts around the state. Let me talk a little bit about innovation in our programs. As we focused on our educational mission under our new strategic plan, We've done three major things, I think. One is we spent a lot of time talking to our customers. From that, we've developed some, I believe, innovative changes to our programming. And the third thing that we've learned is we're spending a lot more time evaluating the results of our work. So let's break that down. Spent a lot of time talking with our customers. In the last year, we've conducted over 30 focus groups, facilitated discussions, and surveys asking students, parents, and teachers, what can we do better? How can we help you? From that, we've learned a couple of things, that students, parents, and teachers are very busy, and they appreciate and will use the work and the services that we can provide them. We've also got some innovative ideas from them that we are putting into place. Let me give you just a few quick examples of that in the remaining time. One is to bring our programs more closely into the classroom. The field trip experience at our sites and museums has long been the backbone of our interaction with the educational system. But we need and are working to help teachers up front to plan for those field trips and to tie it into the curriculum after they have had that experience. The second thing we heard from teachers was, it's great to go to the Northwest Fur Post in April and learn about the fur trade, but if I'm studying the fur trade in February, I need to have an experience, I need to have a program for me there. This is where technology is coming into play. We've adopted a technology that's available in all the school districts in the state called interactive video conferencing. And using this technology, a teacher in a studio at the History Center can provide a lesson on the fur trade, Minnesota exploration, early transportation to school kids around the state. I sat in an example of this in Braham a couple of months ago and watched the participation. The students see the teacher on the screen. The teacher sees the students. She engages the students. Get them out of their desk. It's very lively and interactive learning that happens in real time at the point in the curriculum where the teachers can make the best use of it. It's not a passive experience. It's not the film strip that I watched when I was in grade school or the videos that my children probably there were films in those days, saw in their classrooms. Another thing we learned is that this generation learns differently. It's a generation of digital natives. And the teachers are saying, don't turn off the handheld devices when we come to the exhibit. Use them to capture the information and take it back to the classroom. And we're adopting that technology into a new exhibit that we're developing at the History Center, Our Minnesota. It's a history of the state based on a study of the prairie, the big woods, and urban Minnesota. It will be will utilize this new technology very heavily. The other innovative thing we've done is, as school kids and their parents and their teachers come into the History Center, we're asking them to come in and help us develop the exhibits, to comment, to give us their feedback. So when the exhibit opens next year, it will be student-ready, student-friendly, and student-usable. And finally, we've been doing a lot of work on improving our evaluation. We brought some folks in from the Wilder Foundation to help us strengthen our ability to assess the outcomes of our projects as we go forward. We're certainly employing technology to go back to our strategic plan. We've been scanning collections to putting them online. It's hard for me to talk about it as innovative since we've been doing it since 1997, practically the first institution that I know of like ours that has been making the collections available 24/7 on the web whenever people and wherever people want them. We've engaged in a lot of partnerships. Let me mention two. I mentioned the History Day program. One of our innovative programs has been to engage students, state colleges, the University of Minnesota, the Minsky campuses, to act as mentors who come into the classroom to help the teachers and students with their History Day projects. We're engaging not only the middle and high school students, we're getting the college students involved in that educational experience. Another interesting innovation that I think it's interesting to me, you'll judge whether you find it so, is with our Historic Sites Network. They've long been a destination for families or school groups. But we're now working with those sites to serve as community resources, to work more closely with all the school districts, local historical societies, the Military Museum at Fort Ridgely, wherever we can provide service into the community. They have become our extension service around the state. And that's an exciting new possibility.
Mr. Fox, we're about out of time. Right. If you could wrap up.
I would conclude with that and stand for any questions the committee members might have.
We will have an opportunity again on the tour, and then also when we have you back on the budget to further have an opportunity for questions. So thank you very much.
Thank you. We look forward to seeing you on the 8th.
For being here. And members, tomorrow we have the Downey bill. Meeting adjourned.